He thought he knew why the syndrome had returned. This was probably the most tense period he had ever known in his life. He was not a particularly successful teacher. In fact, he was pretty much a failure. Bell wasn't just a holding tank for second-rate students. It was a refuge for dead-end teachers, too. He had his good points. You could not find a more loving husband. You could not find a better man to father a kid as sensitive and exasperating as Connor. But he tended to the pedantic when he lectured. He was too careful, too humorless, too predictable. Still, he had built a life for them at Bell. Connor's life was here. Caitlin was having a successful career in the sociology department. She was tenured, popular with students, had crowded classes. She was pulling down 70 grand to his 48.5 also. It would not be fair for his failure to uproot her. Tomorrow at 10 sharp, he would have his final tenure review with Marcy. Of course, it wasn't the official word. That came from the tenure committee next week. But by the end of the meeting tomorrow, he'd know. He drove past Marcy's house, noted that all the blinds were down. A signal? An omen? He drove on, circling blocks, but not Marcy's, of course, God forbid, and forcing back these ridiculous, if thankfully silent, tears. When he arrived home, he hoped to avoid Connor. "I was right," his son said as he got out of the car. "I was exactly right."
"Connor, you were wrong. It was a cyst."
"Where is it?"
"Oh, brother, son, it's in the garbage at the health center."
"Dad, do you realize what that is? It's an alien artifact. It's important. There's even a website about them, a lot of websites."
Dan tried to get past his son and into the house.
"Dad, it's important. You're involved in a close encounter situation, and shut up."
He ran across the garage.
"Will you just shut up?"
Caitlin appeared.
"What's the matter with you? What's going on out here?"
"Caitlin, oh God, Caitlin, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Connor, please forgive me, both of you." He tried to smile, failed, shook his head. "Look, Connor, you're always asking for space. I need some space right now. I need some, okay?"
"Dad, are you crying?"
"It's a mild allergy to the anesthesia."
"Dad's just had an operation, Connor. We need to back off."
"But, Mom, he's letting them throw away an implant."
"God damn it. There's no such thing.
Connor, for a supposed genius, you can be an amazing idiot. A website on alien implants is your source of information? You urgently need to learn some discrimination, son. You can do calculus backward and recite Wittgenstein, and yet you come up with this garbage."
"Be careful, Dad. It was Wittgenstein who said, 'Our greatest stupidities may be very wise.'"
Dan knew not to pursue it. No matter how correct he might be, in a sentence or two more, Connor would win the argument. To avoid that, Dan went inside, took a relatively good Barolo out of the wine rack, opened it and grabbed a glass, and headed for the family room. Golf, decent wine, and deep, deep sleep were what he needed. He'd gone over the top, of course. The boy was terribly sensitive, of course. Well, he'd apologize later.
"Connor got under your skin. He really did have a skill at that."
He poured some wine, drank it, and felt his ear. The damned thing had moved again. It had returned to its original site, under the stitch. He considered screaming, but no, that would be rude. Instead, he poured himself another full glass and drank it down. Part 4. The Hanged Man.
"Ah, love, let us be true to one another. For the world, which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night." Matthew Arnold, Dover Beach. 11.
Mike Wilkes watched as one by one the members of the Trust filed slowly through a large white device that was set into the doorway to the conference room on the second floor of his Georgetown home. As each trustee stood waiting in what was essentially a magnetic resonance imaging system reconfigured and retuned to detect very small metallic objects, Mike watched a whole-body image come into focus on a flat-panel display located beside the entrance.
"Come in, Charles," he said to their chairman, Charles Gunn.
"I'm wiped every morning at home," Charles said. "I had one pulled out of my damn neck last week."
Hold it, Richard."
The display showed a bright spot deep in the brain of Richard Forbes, the Trust's security chief.
"They got one in your damn temporal lobe, buddy. Is it deep?"
"Oh, yeah. You're gonna need a neurosurgeon big time."
"Well, guys, I'm out of this for the duration, then. I'll see you after my lobotomy."
There was nervous laughter. Brain implants were rare. They required an abduction, while an object that went in under the skin could be placed while the host was wide awake. All it would do would be to cause some pain, but there would be no wound, certainly no scar. The Greys were, among other things, masters of atomic structure. They could walk through walls if they wished, and they could certainly deposit an implant under the skin without surgery. The terrifying thing about a brain implant was that it could be used for subtle mind control, detectable only by someone with profound understanding.
"They anticipated this meeting," Charles said.
"Yeah. They know damn well we'd want our security guy in a meeting because of a security issue," Henry Verona added as he came through.
Then Ted Cassius had one under his scalp. These were nasties, too, because that close to the brain, they could be used not only for monitoring, but for a degree of mind control as well.
"How long have you had this, Ted?"
"I got a splitting headache 2 days ago. Jesus, I should have known."
"We need to assume that you're both under mind control, and we have to get your asses out of here fast."
He opened his cell phone. "I'm calling for a Secret Service escort for both of you guys to Walter Reed. If you go onto your own steam, you just might change your minds, as you know."
"Thank you."
Nobody else, thankfully, was implanted, and Mike finally was able to take his customary place at the conference table, second from the head on the left. Charles Gunn was head of table. Normally, he would not be at a meeting of the Security Operations Committee, but Mike had specifically requested his attendance. Henry Verona shuffled some papers as the three blind mice took their places. Three sour and mutually indistinguishable liaison officers from the main corporate groups that accepted delivery of the technologies and processes that evolved out of the liaison with Adam. They were Todd Abel, Alex Starnes, and Timothy Greenfield, all in their 40s, all looking like undertakers. It was their corporate dollars that funded the survival program. Creating the database of people who would be sheltered was costly, and monitoring their movements even more so. But those things were nothing compared to the cost of the underground shelters themselves. 100 at $500 million each, hidden around the world.
"Let's get going," Charles said. "I've brought a little patents and processes business to deal with first. Where are we with the plasmonics device?"
Mike was confused by that question. The invisibility fabric was deep in the pipeline.
Do we need more from Adam? Because I wasn't aware."
Tim Greenfield said, "We have a report, Mike. It's on its way to you."
"Then there's a problem, Timmy?"
Tim Greenfield's pate flushed. "It doesn't work."
"Well, that is a problem."
The concept was a material that would reduce light scatter back to zero, thus rendering an object effectively impossible to see. They knew that the Greys used invisibility cloaking in their abductions. In addition to their peculiar physical ability to lock movement with the slightest flickering of the eye, so their victim could not see them. Adam and Bob had been queried on the cloaking, and the tiny bits and pieces necessary to extract information from them for 15 years. They had a $10 billion check riding on the success of the process.
"There's a compositional issue, chemical. We need a real formula. What they've given us is not real."
So the Greys had lied again. All of those years of work, those hundreds and hundreds of tiny, seemingly innocuous questions, had led down another blind alley. Not that they didn't have successes.
"How are we doing with the electrostatic anti-friction shield?"
Mike asked Todd Abel, who was team leader on that project. He knew the answer better than Todd did, but he wanted to remind everybody that his work with Bob and Adam had resulted in its share of successes. It's deploying, and we're looking at a 97% decrease in friction across angular surfaces. If we could mine gravitite, we could fabricate non-aerodynamic spherical vehicles, and we'd be looking at the same zero-friction profile we see in the Gray's craft. All we'd be missing is their engine.
The coherent mercury plasma can't be made more efficient, Henry Verona said. We're getting everything we can out of it.
Mike knew that well. Using a combination of research into ancient Vedic texts about the technology of Earth's previous civilization, and questions to Adam, they had evolved a device that rotated a mercury plasma inside a powerful magnetic field that reduced the weight of the craft that carried it by 40%. Simply knowing that the Vedic references to aircraft and weapons referred to actual devices had enabled scientists to proceed much more quickly.
So what about gravitite? Progress? Charles asked in his peculiarly cheerful voice, so improbable in a man who looked like the director of his own funeral.
We know what it is and where it is, but extracting it is another matter, Mike said.
He looked toward Henry Verona, who was a substantial shareholder in a dozen companies that were feeding off the Gray's technology. One of those companies, Photonic Research, had been mining for years in the same seams of iron in the southern Catskills that the Grays used, pulling iron out of shafts directly adjacent to theirs, but failing to extract more than a few molecules of gravitite. Henry said,
"We're not going to be saving the human race with gravitite. We can pull up the iron and cut it up atom by atom, but we find one atom of gravitite for every 300 billion atoms of iron. The Grays must have a more efficient process, otherwise they would have used up every bit of iron on the planet to get a handful of gravity-negative product."
Charles now rested his eyes on Mike.
"Colonel, if you'd like to go on to the security matter now."
Mike told himself that he wasn't frightened, but he was. He felt like a schoolboy about to get a thrashing.
"We have a potential crisis that needs to be addressed immediately.
Adam's not sick."
Bob had been invaded by common household moles. This was why they kept Adam in an ultra-dry, ultra-clean environment. They were all terrified of losing their only captive Gray.
"Not that, thank the Lord. But something might be unfolding that could be bad for us."
Henry Verona sighed. He was not a patient man, and Mike could see an explosion building. He hurried on.
"Basically, we've obtained information about a very unusual operation on the part of the Grays. Spectacularly threatening, I am sorry to say. What happened initially was that the triad that works Pennsylvania and up into Canada came out of their boundaries and did an abduction in a college town in Kentucky."
"Okay," Todd said. "I'll bite."
"The Grays have devised a way to communicate with mankind,
to teach us how to save ourselves.
They've been working on it for probably a couple of thousand years. And now, gentlemen, they're going to spring it on us. Of course, we save ourselves not for us, but for them. Mankind survives, but as a genetic milk carton for them. Slaves."
That brought total silence. These men had counted on the coming catastrophe to free their carefully selected fragment of humankind from the Grays. None of them liked the idea of the disaster that they knew was coming, but they feared this slavery more. If 6 billion were alive in 2012, they would all be enslaved. If only 1 million were left alive by then, they would be left alone. So at least went the theory.
"So get on with it," Henry Verona snapped.
"Okay," Mike continued. "We've known for some time, based on the abduction pattern we've observed over 5 decades, that the Grays are especially interested in children.
Because they're small, easy to control, and emotionally rich," Henry said. "Easy to feed on,"
he added in a tone electric with contempt. Every man here shared one truth. He despised the Grays.
"That does not explain the why, which has always been our problem. The Grays can outthink us. They're always 10 moves ahead."
Henry slammed his briefcase, which had been open on the table.
"That's it, then. Let's all go home, follow Forrestal out the damn window."
"I'm too old to jump out a window," Charles said. "Mike, you finish this. What's your problem and what do you need from us?"
"Well, wait," Tim said.
What about the scalar weapons program? We're going to have 80 of those birds up by 2012. We'll be able to induce the destruction of most of the species ourselves. He sighed. God help us, I hope it doesn't come to that.
You think they'll sit back and let us kill their cattle?
They haven't touched the scalar prototype.
Because it's only one small weapon, Charles said. It doesn't have the potential to affect their plans.
Mike continued. The Greys are doing something very inventive. What they've apparently done is to breed a child so intelligent that he can process and use the contents of their knowledge. Verona shook his head. You have a problem, Henry? They've been preparing this from the beginning, then? I found out about it early this morning.
Mike, we've known about them for 50 damn years, and you found out today?
Look, let's not argue about me.
I want to argue about you. This is not good enough. Hold off. You hold off and you listen, because this is urgent. Our whole damn program is in jeopardy, the freedom of the human species.
Because somebody didn't do their job, Alex murmured.
Hold off, all of you, Charles said softly. Go on, Mike.
My expectation is that they're going to install something in him that links him to their collective.
An implant does not a demon make?
In this case, it does. This child's intelligence will enable him to use vastly more information than an average human being can. Silence fell. He watched each face as each man explored the implications of this. Gentlemen, Mike said, if this child survives, mankind survives. When the Greys show up in 2012, dinner is served.
Now,
Tim Greenfield asked in his soft Georgia drawl, we are absolutely sure that their coming is bad for us?
You cannot seriously entertain a question where we can't know the answer until it's too late. Good or bad, we can't take the risk.
Why not approach the child, get him on our side? Todd asked.
When we approach him, we approach the Greys, Mike said acidly.
So do the child, Mike, Charles said. Shouldn't be hard, not for a pro like you.
I might remind all of you that every life I took because of this damn thing I took under orders.
I repeat, do the child.
Which is why I'm here.
Charles slammed his hand down on the table.
You don't need our permission, for God's sake, Mike. This meeting is a waste of time. Do the damned child.
Charles, God damn it, will you please give me a chance to talk?
Charles glared at him. Mike continued, my problem is that the Greys are not alone in protecting this child. They have the help of some people within our own organization who appear to have come under mind control. He took his iPod out of his briefcase, plugged in its tiny speaker, and played for them the conversation that had taken place on Lost Angel Road.
It's pitiful, Henry said. Those are good men, all of them.
The hard part is, Mike said, I can see where their choice is coming from. There's a lot of life going to be lost doing it our way. A lot of life.
You've made no headway finding this child, I presume.
No, Henry. I have a description obtained from Adam this morning, and I will undoubtedly find a child who fits it on Oak Road, and kill the wrong child.
Todd said, unless they've given you a description of the right child in hope that you'll assume that it must be the wrong one.
Kill all the children, Henry said. And what in the world are we going to do with Lewis and Rob and Dr. Simpson?
Tell you what, Tim Greenfield said. Let's suck them up in the terrorist thing and ship them to Saudi Arabia. That'll do it. It will also bring in the CIA, AFOSI, and the FBI, not to mention the Saudis. We need a plane crash, an auto accident, a fatal robbery attempt, a nice heart attack, stuff like that, Charles said. Take a year doing them, there's no hurry.
He looked toward Mike.
The sort of thing you're expert at.
The child is our urgent problem, and please let me repeat, the Greys are protecting him.
And so are our friends from Lost Angel Road, don't forget that, Mike.
Tim said, gentlemen, excuse me, Charles, but I think you're panicking here. We have years to deal with this child, and
we do not have years, Mike said. Please get rid of that misconception.
I'm sorry, Mike, but we have until 2012.
We do not, God damn it.
Let me tell you how this will work. The second they possess that kid, or parasitize him, or however you'd like to describe it, he is going to become invulnerable.
Oh, come on.
I have spent the last 15 years of my career sparring with Bob and Adam, and I am warning you, if we let that kid go even a day, we're done, they win. We will not be able to do a single thing to him. He will always outwit us. Good Christ, he's going to be smarter than they are. Alex said, let's put a nuke on the damn town. Pick up the phone and call the president.
I can't imagine him agreeing to that, Charles said. In any case, we need to keep this in-house, if at all possible.
Which gets me to my next question, Henry Verona said. Mike, you have a big rep. Given that you've been sitting at the bottom of a hole for 15 years, may I know why we should believe you're qualified to go operational again?
Charles said,
Henry, you surprise me. Mike is my choice and that ought to be enough, but if it's not, let me lay things out.
Mike didn't always spend his days licking the heinies of those damn great bastards down in that hole. He did a lot of hard, sad, wet work in the early days.
Okay, I get it.
No. You're questioning my authority, Henry. You've done it before and you'll do it again. That's fine, you want to run the show? Very ambitious. Maybe. If they vote me out and vote you in, you'll do okay.
He looked around the table.
Do we want a vote of confidence, gentlemen?
No hand was raised. He went on.
Suffice to say that Mike here had the unfortunate need back some years ago to become a master of untraceable murder. He's got quite a number of notches in his little cap pistol, am I right, Mike?
I've done a few, he muttered. Using anything from a chemical that induces cancer to a mind control technique that makes people kill themselves. And he's never even come close to being caught.
Verona smiled at Mike. Then I'm relieved, the CIA representative said. We can count on you.
Todd spoke up. Obviously, the nuclear option isn't available to us, but I think Alex's concept is a good one. We could do a training accident, say, compliments of Alfred Air Force Base, which is out there in Kentucky, if I'm not mistaken. Blow away the neighborhood with a stray incendiary, say?
Then Herod, when he saw that he was mocked of the wise men, was exceeding wroth, and sent forth and slew all the children that were in Bethlehem, and in all the coasts thereof, from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had diligently inquired of the wise men.
Wilkes paused.
But of course, he added, Herod missed.
If we just do that one little cluster of houses, we might miss too.
However we do it, we have to do it now, Verona said.
Gentlemen, Charles said, I think we've heard enough. Mike, we need to find this child. Would it help if you had a TR?
A triangle is essential. It enables me to enter the community with minimal risk. The Greys will inevitably discover me, but at least it can get me to the scene undetected. Once I'm there, I figure I have a couple of days.
He stood up, signaling that the meeting was ended. Verona was right about one thing. There must be no delay now.
Wait just a minute, Verona said. You're not walking out of here without telling us how you're going to proceed.
I think we have mind control capabilities of our own that can be brought to bear on the situation. We can do this without revealing to the Greys that we're responsible.
How is my business?
There's one system that works, Greenfield said. The violence wire.
Duty calls, gentlemen, Mike said as they started to filter into his living room for drinks. There's no time, not tonight. There's no time at all.
He left then, heading down to the garage in his basement. He needed to get to Wilton, which of course would turn out to be a trap. The larger question was, how exactly did the trap work? And how could it be defeated? If it could.
12.
As Dan entered Marcy's office, he was enveloped in what he immediately perceived as an ominous silence. Behind her, the westering sun made a halo of her glowing russet hair. Her hands, holding what Dan presumed were his student evaluations, gleamed softly in the late light.
Her skin was smooth and her features exotic, with large frank eyes and lips that generally contained a hint of laughter. Not the pleasantly sensual laughter that the face suggested, though. Marcy was first and foremost an administrator. She fired, gave bad news, and disciplined wayward professors for their crimes. Drunkenness, sloth, and, of course, lechery. He imagined her fingers touching him, and it was oddly thrilling. He blinked and shook the thought away. She smiled, and he saw something unexpected. A sort of warmth. "Given what I have here, it would have been useful to you," she said, "if you could have gotten a little more support from faculty." "The student evaluations, ah." "I can't give you details, Dan." "No, of course not." Student evaluations at Bell were held secret from professors so that they could be used as a tool and weapon of the administration. "But they're bad, I assume." She laid the paper back in the file from which she'd taken it, aligned it with a long, deep red fingernail, and closed the manila folder. From outside there came the distant strains of the Bell Ringers band, hammering away improbably enough at Moon River. The sound carried off on the stiff north wind that had come up around noon. Voices echoed along the hall, the comfortable laughter of some succulent co-ed making light, no doubt, of a flapping faculty admirer. "Marcy," he said. He stopped himself, astonished by a shocking and completely inappropriate sense of desire for her. She was doing nothing to seduce him. He looked at her right hand, lying there on the desk. If he reached across that 2-foot space and laid his own hand on it, what would happen? "Yes?" Her voice seemed almost to tremble, but why? Did she have to tell him no, and was she afraid to do that? But why should she be? He was no friend of hers, and bad news was job one in this office. Poor student evaluations and no faculty support. Open and shut case. Toodaloo. "Marcy, look. We both know what's going on here." She laughed a little, the nervous tinkle of a girl. "I think the problem is that your courses aren't sexy." He had arrived at the edge of the cliff. Poor evals, no support now, a negative on his courses. The next step would be, "Sorry, I cannot vote for tenure." "It's physiological psychology," he yammered. "Give me a couple of sections of abnorm, I'll bring my comments way up." "That's unlikely until you're tenured." "But I can't get tenured without good evals, and I can't get those without good courses." "You're Usarian, then." "As we all are. Bell Usarians us all." For a moment he was at a loss, then he remembered Catch-22. Usarian was the character in the novel who was caught in a bureaucratic endless loop. Dan searched for something, anything that might help him. He could drop a name, pitiful, but it was what he had. "I knew a fellow when I was at Columbia. What was his name?" "Speed Vogel, who knew Heller." She made a note. "What are you writing?" "New friend of Heller." "Does it matter?" "Not at all." He found himself watching her lips, the way she pressed them together, the slight and fascinating moisture at the corners of her mouth. But why? Was he going mad? How could he feel this way for this woman who was about to wreck his life? Did he want this so badly that he was willing to whore for it? Probably. But why would she want him? She had her pick of faculty masochists, eager to roll in the hay with their punisher. And yet the only thing that was stopping him from leaping across that desk was the fear that any such action would backfire. "Marcy," he heard himself say, and he heard the roughness, the unmistakable sexuality in his tone. He almost slapped his hand over his mouth, but she looked up suddenly, blinking fast. Her eyebrows rose to the center of the forehead, her eyes filmed with tears that made them bright and awful. "What's the matter?" she asked in a horrible low tone that made him think she feared him. He remembered suddenly his seizure dream, going up into the dark womb of the sky, the cave in the silver moon. He shook it away, frightened for a moment that he was going into aura again. But no, it was only a memory. She cleared her throat, lifted her hand and brushed her lips with the back of it, smearing her lipstick a little. "Yes," she whispered. He said, "Is this the conference? My conference with my tenure advisor? We sit here staring helplessly at each other? There's nothing to discuss, Dan." she said. She straightened herself, clasped her hands, and lifted her chin. She was beautiful then, tragically beautiful. He could see her in the darkness, and she looked very afraid. But no, it wasn't dark, and she wasn't scared. She looked across at him, her eyes steady. It's just, obviously, you know, the student evaluations. Well, you know, they're often rather indifferent to the welfare of somebody they know has need.
They know I'm up for tenure.
She nodded, her little mouth grave, her eyes flashing.
Oh, yes,
she said, and he knew in that moment that he must have her. He must do this. He could not help himself. He also knew that she was aware of the potential that existed between them. He went to his feet. She looked down his body, then cleared her throat. Her cheeks had gone bright red. He stood before her like a little soldier at stiff attention. He said in his heart, "Caitlin, I am so ashamed." But Marcy's rising flush told him that there would be no escape for him. She lifted her hand off the desk and reached toward him, her fingers extending. They froze. Then, remaining like that, him pressing his thighs against the edge of the desk, her reaching to the air 6 inches in front of his midriff. Tears poured down her cheeks. She whispered, her voice an unsure murmur.
What happened last night?
Something in him, some sort of inner door, fell open. He remembered the blaring confusions of his boyhood, the stars passing his face, the field of silver and the black opening gaping. You heard about that. He backed away from her desk. Then he saw a narrow steel cut, Marcy lying on it in heat, her face flushed and sweaty, her bush brown and touched as if by dew. And he felt his own nakedness delicious in the night air. She gasped as if struck. "Dan," she said. "Dan." Her eyes widened, glistened, their green suddenly horrible to see. Too glassy. Too hurt.
"Marcy, listen."
She stood up and came around the desk, entered his arms. She drew against him, drew close, and in the fur of his sweater he heard long and bitter sobs.
"I'm sorry," he said.
"I'm so damn sorry."
She pressed herself against him harder. Then their lips were touching, asking one another if there should be more. If she, of all creatures, she, could be admitted to his sanctum. He laid his hand on her back and pressed her closer to him, and delivered himself to her kiss. 13. Lauren did not have sexual feelings about Adam, of course, and the idea of him having such feelings for her was repellent. But there was something else there. He liked to explore her intensities, sexuality, anger, passion, loss, triumph, her slight kinks, those little fantasies that she sometimes relaxed with, of helplessness and ardor. And her childhood. Adam moved through her childhood memories like a tiger prowling the tall grass. Normally he was curiously empty of emotion himself. You'd almost be willing to believe he was a machine. He was so... not cold. That's an emotion. Adam's heart was empty. But earlier this morning, when he had been showing her the images of the dying cruise ship and the supermarket full of the starving, she had felt such a powerful sense of disquiet that she'd gotten the idea that they represented a great fear of his, and therefore of his whole species. They were a collective, connected in some esoteric way across the whole universe. She thought it had to do with quantum interconnectedness. A gray could communicate instantly with a gray in another galaxy, but hardly at all with a human being. She had come to feel that Adam's ceaseless quest to share her heart was central to his meaning, and probably the meaning of them all. They weren't predators, like Mike thought, but people who had somehow become machines. They were smart enough to know that they were the most profound possible outsiders. They were functional, very much so, but had no access to the emotional universe that seemed to her to be the essence of being alive. She lay staring at the living room ceiling, vaguely listening to Ted's golf tournament on the TV. What was it, the Masters? She enjoyed golf, the precision of it, the struggle, the inner calm that was essential, as well as beating her dear Ted at a game, which she managed occasionally.